Some of my close friends told me they felt the same way. Significantly, those who felt it most acutely were the more battle-wise veterans for whom Okinawa was their third campaign. The bravest, wearied of the suffering and waste, even though they showed little fear for their own personal safety. They simply had seen too much horror. The increasing dread of going back into action obsessed me. It became the subject of the most torturous and persistent of all the ghastly war nightmares that have haunted me for many, many years. The dream is always the same, going back up to the lines during the bloody, muddy month of May on Okinawa. It remains blurred and vague, but occasionally still comes, even after the nightmares about the shock and violence of Peleliu have faded and been lifted from me like a curse. The 7th Marines secured Dikeshi Ridge on 13 May after a bitter fight. Some of the Peleliu veterans in that regiment noted that the vicious battle resembled the fighting on Bloody Nose Ridge. We could see the ridge clearly. It certainly looked like Bloody Nose. The crest was rugged and jagged on the skyline and had an ugly, thin line of blackened, shattered trees and stumps. Our company moved into a smashed, ruined village that an officer told me was Dikeshi. Some of us moved up to a stout stone wall where we were ordered to hold our fire while we watched a strange scene about 100 yards to our front. We had to stand there inactive and watch as about 40 or 50 Japanese soldiers retreated through the ruins and rubble. They had been flushed by men of the 7th Marines, but we were in support of the 7th Marines, some elements of which were forward of us on the right and left out of our field of vision. We couldn't risk firing for fear of hitting those Marines. We could only watch the enemy trotting along, holding their rifles. They wore no packs, only crossed shoulder straps, supporting their cartridge belts. As they moved through the rubble with helmets bobbing up and down, a man next to me fingered the safety catch on his M1 rifle and said in disgust, "Look at them bastards out there in the open, and we can't even fire at them." "Don't worry, the 7th Marines will catch them in a crossfire farther on," an NCO said. "That's the word," said an officer confidently. Just then a swishing, rushing sound of shells passing low overhead made us all duck reflexively, even though we recognized the sound as our own artillery. Large, black, sausage-shaped clouds of thick smoke erupted in the air over the Japanese as each of those deadly 155-millimeter bursts exploded with a flash and a kerump. The artillerymen were zeroed in on target. The Japanese broke into a dead run, looking very bow-legged to me, as they always did when running. Even as they ran away under that deadly hail of steel showing us their backs, I felt there was an air of confident arrogance about them. They didn't move like men in panic. We knew they simply had been ordered to fall back to other strongly prepared defensive positions to prolong the campaign. Otherwise, they would have stayed put, or attacked us, and in either case fought to the death. More of our 155 swished over, erupting above the Japanese. We stood in silence and watched as the artillery fire took its toll of them. It was a grim sight, still vivid in my mind. The survivors moved out of sight through drifting smoke as we heard the rattle of Marine machine guns on our right and left front. We received orders to move out along a little road bordered by stone walls. We passed through the ruins of what had been a quaint village. What had been picturesque little homes with straw-thatched or tiled roofs were piles of smoldering rubble. After bitter fighting, the Awacha defenses and then those around Dikeshi fell to our division. Yet between us and Shuri, there remained another system of heavy Japanese defenses, Wana. The costly battle against them would become known as the Battle for Wana Draw.
This ends Disc 9.